show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Prospectus affiliate. We're a day late this week, you know, because life happens, and there it is. Now, before we get into talking about the big news of the day, which is the CBA, which of course will affect the Royals naturally, as it will affect all teams, but it's not directly dealing with the Royals. But before that, of course, I am Jeff Herr, and with me as always, the unflappable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this wonderful evening?
I'm pretty good. You know, I thought we were going to be talking about the Continental Basketball Association instead of collective bargaining. So I was ready to talk about, you know.
I should have remembered not to just say the acronym.
I was ready to talk about.
I apologize for all your CBA interests.
All of my Atlantic City high rollers research is gone for nothing. It's pointless.
Hey, time that's fun while wasted is not wasted time. Something to that effect.
Right. It was literally the 5 seconds while you were doing the intro because I had to get on the Wikipedia and look it up. So
had to get on the Wikipedias.
On the wikis, as they
say. On the wikis, as the kids these days say, right?
Sure, I think so.
So we'll talk about the actual CBA, which is the collective bargaining agreement, which the Major League Baseball Players Association just came to an agreement in principle. I don't believe that it's actually formalized, finalized, and signed, but in broad strokes, if you will, it's been agreed upon between the Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball. So we're going to hit on a few of the larger, more prominent points here, and kind of discuss, you know, any impacts that the Royals will have that it will have on the Royals. The first thing I think we'll go into that's kind of the biggest talking point that has the most kind of theory to mine here is something Mike and I were talking about a little bit before the show, just to make sure we understood everything correctly, because it gets quite complex here. But talk about qualifying offers and free agents. So the previous system, the way it worked was you offered a qualifying offer to a particular player, which was set at a predetermined amount. Like for last year, I believe it was $17.2 million.
That'll be this year's.
That's this year. Sorry. Yeah, okay.
It was so this 16.7 for the offer for the 2016 season.
And that is an average of a certain number of players. I cannot remember.
125.
Okay.
So 125 salaries. It'll be the average. Those.
So regardless of position, top 125 players.
Yep.
And I don't believe that process for determining the qualifying offer, I don't believe that's changed, right? That's the same?
That is the same. And the condition that the player has to be on the team for the full season is also going to be the same. So just like last year, if a player is traded mid-season, they would not be eligible to have a qualifying offer extended to them.
Okay. And once they are extended a qualifying offer previously under the previous system, had they signed elsewhere, the team that signed them would lose their first round pick unless it was protected, which I believe is the top 10 picks were protected.
Mm-hmm.
And the losing team who lost the free agent would then get a supplemental draft pick. So that's kind of how the old system works. not simple in, you know, everyday simple terms, but in terms of like baseball transactions, pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I'll put it this way. I made a flow chart for what we're about to talk about.
There you go.
For the compensation. And the old system required two lines of text. So
yes, and I just gave them to you.
Right.
Now, so, all right, Mike, well, let's go to the flow chart. I'll ask you a question, and you'll give me the yes or no answer.
Well, I'll ask you the question, because just have to do yes or no questions.
That's so, right. You actually have a chart in front of you.
So let's say that you
are... Let's make a quiz to see if I really understand it, too.
Okay, yeah. Let's say that you are a team that has lost a free agent. So... and we'll assume that you offered them the qualifying offer and that they declined and then they signed with another team. So the first question when we're determining what your compensation will be for losing that player is the contract that the player signs above $50 million or not?
In my example, it will be Eric Hosmer. So yes.
Okay. So are you a team that is paying the luxury tax? Are you paying above the threshold for the luxury tax, which...
The Royals, I am not.
Okay. So that's a no. Are you receiving revenue sharing?
Yes.
Okay. So under those conditions, you will receive a pick immediately after the first round.
Yay.
Yeah. So that and that's when we were talking before the show, is that that's the sweet spot. The Royals are in that spot where if all those conditions are met, they hit all of those and they get the best possible pick. As far as I know, the revenue sharing recipients will still be the bottom 15 markets in baseball. The Royals will still be one of the bottom 15 markets in baseball, as it they probably will be for the rest of our days, unless something strange happens. So in that case, and it's really that $50 million trigger, and that's where it kind of comes in. Every free agent will get compensation, or every qualifying offer free agent that signs with a different team will end up with compensation to the old team. But these are a bunch of different conditions that determine what that compensation is. So... let's go back and say, okay, let's say that the contract was less than $50 million.
Okay.
So in this...
So he's Alcides Escobar this time.
Sure. In this case, we're still going with the Royals as the example. Still not paying luxury tax. So the pick that would be received would be after the competitive balance lottery pick, which was established in the previous CBA and continues in this one, which is basically immediately before the third round of the draft. So last year, this was a pick in about the mid 70, late 70 range. So the third round started with pick number 78. So that would be the pick that if you offer them a qualifying offer, they then decline, they sign for under $50 million, and you're not paying luxury tax, most of those teams will, pretty much most teams in baseball will get at least that pick in that range. If you were a team that was paying the luxury tax, which I think is just the Yankees, Red Sox, Dodgers, and Tigers, I believe. I didn't actually look that up, but I think that's what people said on the Twitter. So as reliable as that may be.
Yes. Twitter never lies.
Right. They would receive a pick after the fourth round. So, and that's pretty cut and dry.
And that is if you are a team paying the luxury tax who lost the player.
Right.
You're receiving after. So essentially, if you pay the luxury tax, it bumps you back around.
Yeah, you're getting a pick after the fourth round, and it doesn't matter contract size. It's just you're paying the luxury tax. You get the worst possible draft pick compensation.
So that's actually two round bump, because if it's right before the third round, if you're not luxury tax, then it becomes after the fourth round. So essentially right before the fifth round.
Yep.
So, yeah, so you lose two rounds right there.
Mm-hmm. So the lesson there is don't pay the luxury tax. Well, I mean, yes. Pay the luxury tax if you are
by all
over
means. If you have to,
but
don't qualify for the luxury tax.
Right. That's a better way to put it. If it turns out that you were not receiving revenue sharing, let's say, yes, the contract is over $50 million, you are not paying luxury tax, and you are not receiving revenue sharing, it would be in the same region as if the contract was below $50 million, that same same area before the third round. And I don't know how they would order them once it gets down to it. You know, I'm not sure on that part, but that's the range that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing.
So interesting part and all that. To me, the most kind of interesting thing, and when they were discussing it on the radio on my way home, Jeff Passan was on 610 and they were talking about it. And the most interesting aspect is this $50 million threshold. I cannot think of, you know, my knowledge of, you know, how contracts work and these types of things go down in the NBA and the NHL is pretty minimal, but I spent a fair amount of time, you know, with going over researching contracts in NFL and stuff like that, because, you know, it's kind of interesting stuff. But I cannot think of any other sport or any other instance in which a compensation system set up how this the qualifying offer system is set up is dependent upon the value of the contract that is then signed. You know, so in football, they changed it with the most recent CBA, but they used to do, and you know, you and I were talking about this before the show, Mike, but they used to do, you could give a first round tender, which is, you know, essentially a contract of X size if a player was an unrestricted free agent, and a, you know, or a third round tender or whatever it was. And so that determined, you know, what the compensation a team would have. They were free to negotiate and free to sign the player, but they would have to give up X value in return, not only or on top of the contract that they would then sign to this free agent. So, but that had nothing to do, like, the, you know, that had to do with the designation that the current team gave the player. So it's not something that you say, okay, we're just going to give this player a tender, and then if they sign for, you know, $30 million to be and make it an NFL equivalent, you know, if they sign for $30 million, then we get a first round pick. But if they sign for less than $30 million, then we get a, you know, fifth round pick or whatever it is. So that's really the kind of the most interesting aspect to me, is that they just came up with this seemingly arbitrary threshold of $50 million. And yeah,
pretty arbitrary.
It's pretty arbitrary. The only possible scenario I can think of is, and it feels like in just reading this and kind of discussing it with you, Mike, that the impetus behind this could very well be the, you know, of most recently the Kendrys Morales and Irvin Santana situations, where you had, you know, both those players sat out until June of a following year after receiving a qualifying offer because teams did not want to give up the compensation required to sign them. But then they both eventually signed, so teams were obviously interested. It's not as though they were washed up. You know, and Kendrys Morales has had some good seasons, Irvin Santana's had some good seasons. So, and there's other players in the past that have been affected by this. So, you know, now with, you know, not having that kind of automatic qualifying offer, lose your first round pick, without that, it becomes a little bit more palatable to sign them to a contract and then allow that player to have, you know, the appropriate amount of time to acclimate themselves to a new team, new culture, all that kind of stuff. So you don't have like what Kendrys Morales did, where he had a rough season in his qualifying offer a year because he was only there for half the year and didn't get to go through spring training and all that. So it kind of feels that way. That's how they've designed it. And then also with the $50 million threshold, almost like, okay, you know, not only are we going to try and make it easier for teams to sign players so they don't lose as much compensation, but we're also going to make it just a little bit easier for, you know, players like a, you know, Ben Zobrist, a little older player who's not going to get a $50 million contract anyway. You know, at that point, and the $50 million, it only really affects the team that's losing the player. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, if you're a team signing a player, say, you know, say Ben Zobrist had been with the Royals for an entire year and they gave him a qualifying offer and then the Detroit Tigers wanted to sign him, you know, if you want the player, you want the player, and you're probably going to sign him anyway in this scenario. But, you know, it can be in the back of their minds where you're like, okay, well, if we sign Ben Zobrist to a $51 million contract, then, you know, the Royals get this pick, which is, you know, higher. Or and I was trying to think if it was just the one pick or the two, but it's the two that are lost. So
yeah, and in that case, if it's the Tigers, if they are paying the luxury tax like I believe they are, they would lose their second highest pick, their fifth highest pick, and money out of their international pool.
So is that the second highest and fifth highest, or is it the second rounder and fifth rounder?
It's the language that I saw in, I think, the AP story was the second highest, which most of the time is probably going to be the second round pick.
Right.
And
for a team like Detroit.
So, you know, it could feasibly be where you're, you know, and maybe some of that would be on the timing of thing. I don't know. But the way I saw it was second highest, fifth highest, but basically second round, fifth round. So that's one of those details that I think is still,
so it's essentially
a little murky on how it's going to work out.
So the goal is obviously for second round and fifth round, but if you have a scenario where the Tigers, for some reason, you know, maybe they had a lot of previous qualifying offer guys or something, and they ended up with a couple sandwich picks, then, you know, theoretically the second highest pick could be before the second round.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're obviously not going to get any competitive balance picks, but, you know, should that situation arise, I'm guessing that's because, it's like, you know, if you're the Rays in, I think it was 2012, 13-ish, when they had like 12 picks in the first 45 or whatever it was.
I think it was 2011. It was just I think it was the last year of that CBA where they were able to do that. But they, I mean, that old system, they were able to, they traded for like three or four players who were going to be type A free agents.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the year, you know, there was no condition then on a player spending a full season with the team. All they had to do was basically offer them arbitration. And if they declined it and signed elsewhere, the Rays would get a sandwich pick between the first and second rounds. And so they got like three or four extra first round picks basically by just going out and, you know, trading for guys for maybe 2 months out of the year. The value not being necessarily that player on the field, but the compensation that they were going to return when you hit the off season, which, I mean, it's a smart way to game the system, but it's also one of those things that, you know, the baseball didn't really want to.
It's not in the best interest of the player.
Yeah. And so the, you know, it just, the new system, it's, you know, like I said, the, for instance, the Tigers, they would lose a couple of picks. Any other team, if they sign a player who received and declined a qualifying offer, they would lose their third highest pick. So it's not the same kind of penalty as that first rounder, which discouraged so many teams from passing up on Frank or Kendrys Morales. Franklin Morales is a different story. So that, you know, the risk then was that, okay, Morales, maybe he's not going to be that good. We don't want to pay him, have him stink, and also lose a first rounder in the process. And that's kind of how he ended up, you know, going so late. And this time it's like, well, the losing your third highest pick is a lot less discouraging. You know, it's a lot smaller deterrent from going out and signing those players, which is, you know, like you said, that's the kind of idea. You want those players who, you know, feasibly are going to be in demand. You want them to be able to realize the full level of the demand that the market would have for them without it being constrained by whatever draft pick you might lose. So the third highest pick, you know, that's pretty comfortable for any team to give up, to where I don't imagine they're going to fret too much about losing that pick, whether it's the, you know, I don't know what pick that might be for, you know, depending on how the balance, you know, the competitive balance lottery pick and the, you know, whatever other compensation picks line up. You know, if you've got two picks ahead of that, but just by definition, then you're going to be at least pretty comfortable. And so you shouldn't run into that kind of situation, I wouldn't think. Mm-hmm. Plus there's kind of this built-in element that the teams that are already paying a lot in payroll have a disincentive, if they want to keep these things, to not go crazy on signing all of these guys who were, you know, given qualifying offers, because they're already over the luxury tax and they're going to be losing a lot of picks. A lot of their ability to sign, you know, new players, you know, either from international sources or from the draft in that next year, because they just won't have the picks or the money for it, because they sacrificed them all signing, you know, three or four guys who got qualifying offers. I mean, maybe it's worth it if you just don't care and you're just going to go for it. And that's certainly a decision that they can make, but you know, it looks just like that's the design, is to, you know, really keep those very high spending teams and consistently high spending teams from going crazy like that. So, you know, some of those situations, you probably see a lot of those, you know, qualifying offer players spread out among, you know, teams besides the usual suspects, as teams are more likely to sign them and aren't quite, you know, taking the penalty of losing a first rounder, which, you know, can really make it so that, you know, a guy like Kyle Loesch a couple years ago got a qualifying offer, and who's going to sign Kyle Loesch if you know you have to give up a first round pick? I mean, I think someone did. I think the Brewers, I don't know. I mean, that's how Kyle Loesch of a transaction that is that I don't remember who the heck did it.
And that's how Kyle Loesch of a transaction that is.
I mean, it's just
well played.
Yeah. But it is a lot more complicated with a lot of different conditions, and I'm not sure how that $50 million is going to play in. I think the example you gave of say the Tigers know that if they sign a guy for 49 versus 50 million, well, maybe your division rival doesn't get as good of a pick, and that could certainly do it. And what we haven't seen is how option years, how buyouts, how incentives, how, you know, milestone clauses and, you know, award bonuses and things like that would fit into that. Because, you know, one thing that when we were kind of chatting about this last night, you know, Dave Leslie was like, you know, what's to stop a team from signing someone to like 3 years, $48 million with three more years that vest at 45 plate appearances, you know, just something completely mm-hmm. gimmicked and transparent that is the easiest of easy performance triggers to reach, you know, then what's to stop them? If it's based on a guaranteed value, option years aren't considered guaranteed. So I, you know, that might be something that teams kind of mess with. I think that's interesting to kind of to keep an eye on when that
and that could be something where you look from, you know, if you're the owners and you're looking from that perspective, okay, this makes a lot of sense to us, because, you know, even if you, even if you can game the system with an option year type scenario, you're still putting yourself in a position where you're most likely not locking yourself into as many huge contracts, you know. So maybe this is kind of the first step of the owners trying to say, we want to move away from these absurdly gigantic contracts. And, you know, you can keep the AAV the same. Like if you're Yoenis Cespedes, who just signed his contract, making 27.5 million, but, you know, a shorter term deal versus your, you know, David Prices of the world and, you know, with the $217 million contracts over 7 years and things like that. So it remains to be seen, but, you know, this could just be like a little tiny attempt at slowing down the prevalence of all these huge contracts.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird that that's how it turns out, because that's my assumption, is that there are going to be some of these kind of mid-level things. Like, if you're looking at, you know, like a Rich Hill this year, and this offseason doesn't apply to these because the offseason had started with the current CBA in place. You know, Rich Hill is probably the top guy in this free agent class. So
that's how Rich Hill of a free agent class it is.
Exactly. It really is. I mean, it's a crap year, which I guess is kind of nice that these rules aren't in there, because it'd be basically a lot of boring third round compensation picks, because who cares about some of these guys? But, you know, like if a team wants those top guys, say the top five free agents in a free agent class, they're going to get them. And I don't think that they're going to worry that much. I mean, just like, you know, the Royals weren't discouraged at all. I mean, well, they were probably discouraged a little bit, but it didn't stop them from signing Ian Kennedy, despite the fact that they were going to lose a first round pick. They wanted Ian Kennedy. They signed Ian Kennedy. Done deal. That's all it comes down to. If you want the player, they'll still sign him. So I don't think that like the main free agents are going to see much of a problem. I think you might see some of those kind of mid-level guys, you know, really kind of fall into that kind of mid-range, you know, under that 50 million threshold. The other weird thing is that it's 50 million. It's not like, you know, if you looked at the qualifying offer amount of $17.2 million, over 3 years, that's $51.6 million. It would kind of make sense to just make it an escalating thing that's three times the qualifying offer, but it's not doing that, because the qualifying offer is just going to continue to go up until probably the next CBA, and they maybe change it again. And, you know, I mean, it's probably going to be like $18 million next offseason, and then 18.5 or something. And so, you know, the closer you get is, you know, you might be having like a $20 million qualifying offer, and that same kind of threshold of $50 million is still going to be in there. So maybe the first two or three years of this CBA, that's, you know, you're not going to see as many of these, you know, kind of conditions of the contract size. And maybe once the average annual salary starts going up, you'll see it be more of an issue. But it's really, it's a weird number to fall on. And I'm not sure how they arrived at 50 million. It does feel completely arbitrary. It's another one of those things you just kind of, I guess we'll have to see how it actually plays out in practice, and how much teams obviously kind of skirt that kind of, you know, that triggering level, and see how it works. It's interesting, but it's weird.
Yeah. And if one thing's for sure, if there's a way to exploit the system to the gain of a baseball team, some baseball team out there will find it.
Oh yeah. I mean, they'll spend probably all year with certain teams, you know, just guys trying to figure out what things you can get away with. And, you know, why not? I mean, what the heck?
I mean, anytime you're in that,
it's a kind of a scenario. $1 billion industry with, you know, there's only 30 general managers in baseball. So, you know, if you want to stay on top of that, you got to be a little cutthroat and a little sneaky.
Yeah. So with that, we'll kind of move on to the next point. We got a couple interesting high level points here. The maybe the kind of most one that might get the most play just because it's kind of humorous is that the All-Star game, or the prestigious, just honor-filled event that is the baseball All-Star game will no longer decide home field advantage. This article says the playoffs, but I'm assuming it just means the World Series.
Yeah.
So, which leads the question, Mike, what are these guys possibly going to find any motivation to play for in the All-Star game?
Well, pride. Pride and love of the game, right?
Pride and love of the game.
That's why any of them are playing, correct?
So far as I know, that's what I'm always told.
I did see something, and again, you know, I saw this last night, and a lot of this stuff is kind of like, you know, a source of this, you know, so I, until it's actually there, I don't know, but that there may be like a bonus to the players on the winning team, which, you know, money talks. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's still like, you know, if you're, you know, you're going into mid July and you probably have an idea of, you know, maybe four or five teams in either league that are not going to be World Series contenders, and they're sending one, maybe two guys. What, that guy doesn't care about which league gets home field advantage. The players who are probably, you know, there might be two or three teams who send players there who really have any kind of like strong caring about that. You know, not to say that they don't care if they win or lose the All-Star game, but that it's just like, I think they're still going to, you know, that they've continued and always have made it an exhibition, and that it's still an exhibition. I mean, I get what the idea behind making this one counts, you know, back, you know, after that tie in the All-Star game. But, you know, I don't know. I just remember when that tie in the All-Star game happened, I didn't care that much, you know, that it was a tie. You know, it was kind of lame, but it wasn't like an outrage. It wasn't something that required some huge steps to correct it. It was, okay, they tied in an exhibition game. They tie in spring training games. Who cares? And so this was the solution, and it was never seemed to make a lot of sense to have World Series home field advantage tied to how an exhibition game turned out, especially one that's determined by, you know, in a large sense, by fan votes, you know.
I mean that was the absurdity of the whole thing, was that it wasn't even like this is a well thought out process. It was completely reactionary, just because Bud Selig was too flustered to come up with a reasonable solution to an All-Star game in extra innings where they were running out of players. So his solution to make up for it was, I guess, the assumption at the time, that was 2002, so I can't really remember everything exactly around it, but I guess the assumption was that the reason it was tied for so many innings was the players weren't trying that hard. So if there was this an additional incentive there that they would try harder and you'd never end up in a tie, I guess. I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I think you look at it like, you know, in football, there's a lot of consternation about the Pro Bowl and if it's necessary. And, you know, every couple years, somebody will get a big time injury in the Pro Bowl, and it'll be a big deal. And people will talk, is this game really necessary? And I mean, the answer is no, it's not. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for, you know, recognition of players and stuff, and the players like it and that kind of a thing. But especially when you get to the All-Star break and you have, you know, everyone gets some time off and all that kind of stuff, I don't know that a player, they definitely like being All-Stars, but I don't know that they necessarily care a ton to play in the game from the standpoint of, you know, like time off would be nice. I'd rather rest and get ready for the second half of the season than playing this game, you know. So you could almost argue, and one of the things that was brought up about the Pro Bowl that I think I liked the best was, you know, get everyone together the week before the Super Bowl and have like a skills competition, you know, and then you know, you don't put people in as much danger and everyone's fine and it's still fun and everyone's together and you get the recognition. So I feel like something like that would be reasonable, you know, where you have, okay, the home run derby, they already got the home run derby. So you just do that like you've always done it. Yeah. And, you know, that's super fun. And then, you know, maybe you have, I don't know, land speed tests. I don't know, something. You can have some sort of skills competition, you know, like how many.
I mean, I want them to put the big trash bucket at home plate and have outfielders hit it like Tommy Mansky.
There you go.
That's what they need to be doing.
There you go. Yes.
This is the one that gets results.
Oh, breaking news. Just got an update on my phone.
Uh-oh.
You ready for this?
Is it
affecting the Royals?
Yep. I think I know what you're going to say.
Trading pitcher Brooks Pounders to the Angels for pitcher Jared Ruxer. I know nothing about Jared Ruxer. Mike, can you add anything on this?
Let me scroll around on Twitter. Jeffrey Flanagan says that Ruxer had Tommy John surgery his final year at Louisville in 2014.
That is a prerequisite for being with the Royals, by the way. You got that out of the way.
Brooks Pounders had his Tommy John surgery recently. Mm-hmm. And Ruxer had a strong start last season in A-ball. Also, Brooks Pounders being traded opens up a spot on the 40-man roster. So
there we go.
That's it. And Fake Ned is lamenting all of this because, as we know, for 5 years he made Brooks Pounders jokes. And
he did.
He will continue to do so, I'm sure, because he will. Because
that's how it happens.
That's what he does. But, yeah. I mean, you know, Pounders pitched okay in a couple of games last year and didn't pitch very well in a couple of games last year. You know, he's kind of one of those guys they got in a trade and he made it up. And I think that's always a success, but you know, it's not that big of a deal.
No,
we wish him well and we welcome Jared Ruxer.
Yes.
And we'll see what he does.
Indeed. So apologies for the little breaking news break there. Won't be breaking anymore when you hear this, but that's okay. So anyway, back to the All-Star game.
All-Star game, skills competition. So
I would love to see that actually. Put a trash can at home plate and give, similar to the home run derby, you know, and then you get like a golden ball, you know, and you can make that throw. You know, all the right fielders go out there and compete, and then all the center fielders, and or I guess there's no discrimination in the All-Star game like the Gold Glove. So I guess it's just all the outfielders.
Yeah.
And then you could have, let's see, what else could you have from a baseball skills competition?
You could try to do like targeted hitting, I guess.
Yeah,
it's
they
not
have like
as easy.
I've done. They've had that in like video games. I feel like that I've done instead of a home run derby.
MVP 2005 had that where you would hit it off like ramps and stuff and different targets and things.
Yeah, like little zones, and if it hit the zone, you got a certain points and different things like that. Like that takes more skill than hitting a home run. You know, I mean, if you can pinpoint where you're going to hit the ball, I think. I guess maybe in the batting practice scenario, maybe not, but
yeah. I know they do bunting competitions in spring training just to, you know, goof around. I wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely have foot speed.
Advocate that, but, you know. I don't know
what
else.
But the point is, you know, just All-Star weekend or All-Star break. Get all the All-Stars there. Do a home run derby. Do a couple other skills competition. Maybe have some events. Have some fun. You know, have like a really long day of batting practice and warming up that, you know, fans can come out and see them and stuff. But like, you know, I mean, it's an easy way to get rid of the game that doesn't really need to be there in the first place. So
I think I hate the Pro Bowl because the Pro Bowl is terrible. And by the time you get through it, basically everybody's been named a Pro Bowler because guys don't want to play or they're going to play in the Super Bowl the next week. At least in baseball, it's like relatively close to the same game you might see on any given day. You know, they still play defense. they don't play defense in the NBA or the NFL game. I still enjoy it, but it certainly does not need to have the home field advantage attached to it. So I think this is something that we've waited on happening for a long time, just because it never should have happened in the first place. Now they've at least corrected that, and maybe some people will say, well, no, it's not fair. Whatever, right? It's the All-Star game. It's still an exhibition. It still does not count in the standings. So
yeah, if your enjoyment of baseball is ruined because you now think that players will not try in the All-Star game because it no longer has World Series home field advantage, then you are past the point at which I can help you. So I hate to be so blunt, but it's just that's kind of how it is. It's not really effectual.
Yeah, it's not a huge deal.
No. So anyway, another kind of interesting one that will provide some, interesting scenarios. The disabled list has now, the shortest tenure has now decreased from a 15-day list to a 10-day requirement. So, of course, the way disabled lists work is if you're on the 15-day DL, then you're no longer counting towards the 25-man roster for that time period, and they can bring somebody else up. And then you can stay on the disabled list as long as you want, but I believe after the 15 days, then you have to come back onto the 25-man roster, and you can't just – nobody else can have that spot for you. So –
well, they can be on the 15-man disabled list until they're ready to come back. It's just that, because most of the times procedurally, guys will end up on the 15-day disabled list. Like if Tim Collins, I think, was one of a lot of these Tommy John guys, they go on the 15-day disabled list first because, there's not really a move that requires them to go to the 60-day DL. So when they're on, they go to the 60-day DL, which is not changing. I haven't seen anything about that changing. When you go to the 60-day, then you are off of the 40-man roster and someone can come up to fill that and really they don't even do that until they don't move you onto the 60-day DL until you basically have to be moved there to make the space available.
Okay, so that's the distinction. So the 15-day, you don't count towards the 25, but you do count towards the 40 still. And then the 60-day, yep. You don't count towards the 40?
Yep, yep. And okay. Then if you're activating off of the 60-day DL, you have to find an open 40-man roster spot. Yes. If you're coming
Which
back
never
from
happens.
The, yeah, if you're coming back from the 15-day, then that's usually where you see the guy get, someone is optioned up, and then as soon as the player is healthy and they come back, that player is usually optioned down or somebody's optioned down or cut or whatever. And then you just kind of go back to business as usual. And then the 10-day will work kind of the same way. I didn't really read a lot of rationale behind it, but, you certainly do see plenty of times where a guy just needs a few days. I think it was last season when Chesler Cuthbert ran into Sal Perez and Perez was out for like 5 days. They kind of just had to wear it and just have him around, even though they weren't entirely sure when he was going to come back because they didn't want to put him on the 15-day disabled list because they knew it wasn't going to be 15 days, but they weren't sure if it was going to need more than the five. So they, with the 10-day, at least you can kind of get in the middle of that. Maybe call somebody up and not be basically going on 24 men on your roster because one guy is just not playable, but you didn't put him on the disabled list. So 10 days kind of, gets those smaller injuries and allows those to be done quicker and you can kind of turn them back around. And in a way that kind of gives you more incentive to actually put someone who's a little dinged up on the disabled list. Because you're not losing another 5 days from them. It's the same thing when they establish that 7-day disabled list for concussions, because before if a guy was concussed, you might think he's going to be okay in about a week, but you don't want to waste, you don't want to wait 2 weeks for him to come back. So you might, you know, fudge around and maybe he's playing when he doesn't need to and the symptoms and the problem gets worse. Well, at least with the 7-day concussion disabled list, it gives them some way to put that guy on a disabled list, but you get them back quicker for that particular condition. And the 10-day is kind of another offshoot of that, it seems, which, you know, you might see like guys who need to skip a start. That might be something that teams do to kind of manipulate it and play around with it. Because then if, you know, if you take a day off on the 1st and your next scheduled day would have been the 6th, then your next scheduled day would be the 11th, you only lose one start for one disabled this trip instead of probably two. And so it's a lot easier to skip a start that way. Plus, you don't have to just, you know, if you otherwise would have skipped him, he's not on the disabled list, you're short a pitcher. Now you can put him on the 10-day, call someone up, have another arm in your bullpen or as a long reliever or spot starter, and then turn around and flip him back when that soreness is gone or what have you. So it's kind of interesting. It's I don't know if it's going to have huge implications, but it, you know, might make a team like the Royals who have, you know, Chris Young, you know, is notably injury prone. Lorenzo Cain has had his share. You know, gives them that chance to kind of throw them on there, but get them back quickly.
Yeah, and it at least, you know, for what it's worth, I suppose, lines up well with the 10-day minimum. For, because isn't it, if a player is called up from the minors, they have to be up for 10 days before they can be sent right back down?
Or is it, they have to be in the minors before they can come back up, unless they're replacing someone who was hurt. So, but yeah, it does kind of work in a similar kind of way, in that at least, you know, you can kind of get it to match.
There's a consistency of 10 days.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe it won't come into play that often, but it's something. It's, you know.
It's in there, so it's notable. They felt the need to change it, so we felt the need to talk about it. There you go. Most of the talk today was geared towards the qualifying offer threshold, which is, that was the real meat of what most people thought was going to change.
And really, especially for the Royals, because this takes effect after 2017, where the Royals have Wade Davis and Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas and Alcides Escobar and Danny Duffy and these guys who could potentially get qualifying offers, you know, before, you might say, let's write it out. Let's have all these guys here. We'll give them qualifying offers. They'll go sign somewhere. You know, we'll have our second World Series title in 3 years. And they can give us first round draft pick compensation when they all sign somewhere. Now it's a little bit different. Now it's, you know, does that change the decision making on Wade Davis? Does that, you know, make you more likely, less likely to trade someone in midseason if you're at 500? You know, because if you're only going to get maybe a third round pick instead of a first round pick because you're not sure that Lorenzo Cain's going to be healthy enough to get a $50 million deal, maybe you might trade him and try to get some AA all-star and some lottery ticket, because at least you know what you're getting and you're not kind of in the dark hoping you'll get a first round pick when you may only get that third round compensation. So maybe it makes them more aggressive on trades. Maybe it doesn't. You know, Ken Rosenthal sent a tweet that, or a series of tweets that was basically, you know, going, well, would the Royals want to try to give them all qualifying offers, get, you know, all these different levels of compensation all in the same draft? Is that, you know, where you're kind of, you know, you trust your scouting, but, you know, the draft is still a little sketchy sometimes. And, you know, if you're, you know, just kind of spending, you know, the third round draft pool money isn't great. It's, you know, not going to be super substantial. So if you get like four guys who are getting that level and you have one guy who gets that first round compensation, then, you're not adding a ton to your draft. You're adding something, but not a ton. And most of those guys are going to be, you know, third round picks that you may or may not ever really see them develop. They probably have better odds, but you know they're not as certain in your mind as the first round picks might be. So, you know, maybe that impacts the way they approach things this offseason. That's something they're going to have to think about, and I think it's an interesting wrinkle into how things may play out this winter.
Indeed. Indeed. And some of the things, a couple smaller notes as we kind of round out the higher points. Some of the things that kind of went more towards the players part of the negotiation. The season will now start midweek as opposed to previously starting on a Monday. And it will, with that, it'll be the midweek, like the week before it normally starts. So they're basically extending the season, you know, roughly 5 days. And those additional days they're adding are spread throughout the season in terms of off days. So more off days for players, keeps them fresh. Fresh players play better baseball. You get to see a better product. Five more days, not going to hurt anybody. Season ends at the same time, just starts a little bit early. Earlier baseball, never a bad thing. Seems like win-win all the way around in that scenario. Except, I guess, if in the case where you're like, oh, man, we have two off days in a week or something.
Yeah, those are painful.
Those can get kind of annoying. When you're all hyped for baseball and then you have like three games in the first 7 days, it's like, man, this is.
When they throw those in April. That first week of the season where it's like you have opening day and then a day off. And it's like, that is such a tease. That is not fair.
Yes. And
not cool baseball.
The baseball minimum salary has jumped up from $507,500 up to $535,000 and eventually will reach $550,000.
I would take a $28,000 a year raise.
Yes, I would as well. Let's see. So yeah, that's pretty much that. Even on this article that Mike and I were kind of using as reference from Baseball Prospectus, it is stated that this is essentially just an extension of the previous CBA with the finer points that we mentioned being changed. So, you know, with the exception of the qualifying offer stuff, nothing else is really groundbreaking or will really alter the way teams do business.
Yeah. There were some rumblings that they were potentially going to add a 26th roster spot, which would have been interesting. Like, to me, I think the Royals could have used that for like a Terrence Gore, which would have been, you know, kind of a way that, you know, you might get to see that theoretical thing that we've written about, or we haven't, Clark has written about on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City, about like using Terrence Gore and being more aggressive with pinch runners and using that to strategic advantage. You know, if the Royals have an extra roster spot, that allows them to possibly use Gore at some point, because you would still have Dyson available for pinch running duty. And so maybe you can be a little more aggressive. And that would have been interesting to see, but they didn't really get to that. There was some talk about changing the way that September and expanded rosters would work. That I didn't even really see much about that. Like, that didn't really pick up a lot of steam from what it seemed like from reports. So that will stay the same. So yeah, there's not really anything that groundbreaking. There's, you know, the international draft we talked about maybe a month or so ago that was pitched, and that looked like it might be a sticking point that the owners wanted pretty badly. And then they finally kind of realized that, hey, that's going to hold up a lot. The players' union did not want that. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the kind of compromise in that is international bonus pools are going to range from like $4.75 to $5.75 million, depending on market size. So,
well, we also talked about, you and I talked previously about how, you know, international draft, the effect of that, you know, not just from a team's perspective of having to deal with it but then the player's perspective, right? Because, you know, a player like take Will Myers, for example, where I was drafted him, everyone thought he was going to go to college. That's why he's like a fifth round pick. Third round. Okay.
Yep.
So that's what everyone thought he was going to go to South Carolina. That's where he was committed to. But he ended up signing. Had though he not been able to work out a deal with the Royals, and he didn't like what he was getting offered, then he just goes to college. No big deal.
Yep.
You know, but you know, in a lot of the, you know, if you go and I'm not sure exactly what, you know, like a Salvador Perez or Alcides Escobar's backgrounds were, in, you know, Venezuela or, you know, a lot of the South American countries and stuff. But, you know, there's a lot of poverty down there and a lot of players who come from less fortunate means. And so, you know, if there was an international draft and all of a sudden the player is subjected to you either play for us or you don't, and here's what we're offering, then, you know, they're option is they don't have the option of like, okay, I'll just go to college, you know, I've got this scholarship waiting for me. It's not always cut out to have, they don't always have that option, you know. It's like, and you know, you don't want to overgeneralize too much, but that is a, you know, a legitimate factor, and it's an important one to consider too, because it's, you know, well, you got to look out for the best interest of the players as well. So kind of I'm glad they didn't really touch the They didn't shift to international draft, I should say.
Yeah,
but
and at least with the, you know, the bonus pools, it's still limited. It's still like that's not a lot of money.
No, that's actually the first thing that we really kind of talked about was, man, and that is not
it's
very much.
Not because I mean I don't remember it off the top of my head, but back in 2012, I think the Royals signed Raul Mondesi for $2 million as a 16-year-old, and they signed Elia Hernandez for like 2.5 or something. I mean, that's your spending. That's your spending for the year. So, you know,
well, we talked about Noel Arguelles, who got like a $7 million contract.
Yeah, it's just like
now he was Cuban. I guess I don't.
Yeah,
I'm
the Cuban
he still
rules
counted, but I guess the Cuban rules could be different.
I'm
not even sure.
There were some changes in the CBA on those things. You know, there's only I had to partition it on my level of understanding for now. And also, I don't know if that's going to be that pertinent to the Royals immediately. But yeah, it was like, you know, that puts the Royals in that kind of position where they've, you know, a couple of years ago that you can kind of just spend willingly. And now it's a little bit limited. And but at least for the players involved, you know, it gives them the opportunity to be talking to multiple teams to maybe leverage that to their benefit, and to also find the team that fits best with them. Like if there's, you know, someone who's kind of been scouting in Venezuela and they see this kid when he's 14 and they kind of keep in contact and he's in some of the like academies or camps down there or something informally, and then later trains with a lot of the same players and yada, yada, yada. You know, that's probably a more comfortable situation for that guy if he's looking to sign somewhere. If you're, you know, practicing with guys you know are, you know, part of the Royals Venezuelan team, you know, you might be more likely to sign with that team because of the comfort level. And, you know, I mean, the thing that, you know, I don't know if this is really related to the CBA, but it's just like when you think about those guys, like when I was 16, I think I was working at Burger King, you know. And that was enough of an adjustment for me to just join the workforce, period. It's not like, okay, now you're going to travel away from your family and you're going to be a professional baseball player. You're going to be, you know, all these different expectations handed out to you. And in some cases, maybe you have to go somewhere where you're not comfortable with the language or the culture is a little bit different. That's a lot. And so I could see why, you know, somebody would want to have some more control and decision making about where they're going to sign and where they're going to commit themselves to play, you know, for whatever organization. Because you look at Chester Cuthbert signed a long time. He's been in the organization forever. And, you mm-hmm. know, that's a big choice to have to make. And so at least the lack of a draft gives them that option that isn't just take it or leave it. They get to actually pick what situation they want to get into and can make that decision on, is the money right to maybe alter what I might be comfortable with, and can kind of work it that way. So, I mean, that's the biggest thing to me as far as like an international draft versus this kind of system. At least maybe the money's capped, but at least you give the players that kind of decision making. They have agency over their, you know, where they're going to go and negotiations and things like that.
Indeed. So I think with that, that's enough CBA talk. I think we'll kind of wrap up the show. One other final thing, we did have kind of a Royals news nugget we haven't really talked about. So Mike, get your thoughts on this. We already lost Kendrys Morales to free agency, of course, and now Edinson Volquez has signed with the Miami Marlins, so he will for sure not be back. What are your thoughts? Let me hear them.
Well, you know, I think Volquez pitched really well in 2015, pitched, you know, very well in the playoffs. Obviously, you know, he kept the Royals in it in Game 5 of the World Series. You know, he pitched that Game 1 of the World Series where, you know, unbeknownst to him at the time, his father had passed away, and he went back to the Dominican through the funeral, came back, pitched Game 5, you know, and pitched well throughout the 2015 season. You know, very adequately replaced James Shields from 2014 to 2015. And then last year, he wasn't that good. I mean, he was like Jeremy Guthrie in the final days kind of level of performance. So I hope he gets it back in Miami. It's a 2-year and $22 million contract there, which is $2 million more than what he got from the Royals for 2 years. So, you know, that kind of shows you where the market is on average to even maybe below average kind of pitchers with some track record, that he could pitch poorly last year and got a raise for the same number of years. And he's older too, so, you know, that's got to be considered. But, you know, I don't think the Royals had strong intentions to re-sign him. And when Jason Vargas came back and looked pretty good, they probably felt like it wasn't something they needed to really pursue with Volquez. And, you know, we'll see kind of where they continue to fill out, if they do something for a fifth starter or what have you. But, you know, he'll have his place, definitely. But practically, I don't think that it's like a big loss. I think they'll be able to find the innings somewhere and possibly, you know, better performance over those innings. But, you know, I hope he gets it, you know, going again. He's a good personality, you know, fun to watch most of the time. And, you know, we'll always have the, you know, the postseason experience where he, you know, pitched pretty well.
Yes. And one of the best memories will be, Mike, you and I, Game 1 of the ALCS we went to in 2015.
Way up in the nosebleeds.
Way up there. Literally the backs top row. Were against the wall.
Yeah.
Literally, the seats ended, or I'm sorry, the steps ended at our seats. That was like just the funniest moment walking up to those seats. But
we just kept
still walking. We were there, and it was awesome. We actually could still see things pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Not a bad seat in Kauffman, really.
True.
But just Volquez, I mean, ended up winning that game 5-0. Volquez pitched really well for 5 innings, and then he struggle bust all the way through the 6th inning. But, man, possibly one of the most intense moments of live baseball I've ever seen or I've ever been a part of, where just, you know, bases loaded. I mean, I think it was – I mean, he had to go through the heart of that lineup too, if mm-hmm. I remember. And yep. I can't even remember who he – was it Encarnacion that he struck out to end the game?
I think it was.
But, I mean, it was just like, oh, my God. Everyone was – I mean, you could feel the nervousness in the air from the entire stadium. And then he finally, you know, bases loaded. He strikes out the last guy, and everyone just erupts.
Yeah, and the spontaneous Eddie chant.
Yes. I mean, it was kind of over after that. So, yeah, he – I mean, 2015, he was a big piece of that team. And, you know, last year he had his struggles. But, yeah, I, too, hope he gets it back together. Always seemed like a really great guy, fun presence, really good in the locker room. And, you know, best of luck to Eddie Volquez. So I think with that – so I think with that, we'll end this the show here. We spent a lot of CBA talk, kind of in the weeds a little bit, but it's good stuff. You know, it's important to knowing how baseball works. It's literally inside baseball. but we hope you all enjoyed it. So we'll continue to bring you shows that now that the CBA is figured out, the winter meetings can commence, and I really hope we haven't been building this up too much. I hope something happens. I heard Jeff Passan on the radio today say that a name he keeps hearing mentioned is Wade Davis. Wasn't clear whether that was from the Royals or from other teams. I'm assuming other teams. Regardless, yeah, we're going to be asking about Wade Davis. I know that – I think the Royals have – I do think the Royals have learned their lesson from Joaquin Soria in the past, not trading him when they could have gotten the most value. Mm-hmm. So I think they'll be open to a Wade Davis trade. But I don't think they will trade him to make a trade.
Right.
You know, it's obviously a valuable piece to this team, so they'd love to keep him. But if somebody blows him away, a la Andrew Miller, a la Aroldis Chapman,
yeah,
that trade will be made. I have faith. So,
if you've got a chance to get like a top five hitter and pitcher or top 10 hitter and pitcher out of someone's system, yeah, they would probably do it. But yeah, I agree. They wouldn't do it just to move him. They're not looking for an excuse to move him. They're going to try to make the market work for them. And really, there's Kenley Jansen and Mark Melanson and Aroldis Chapman are the three big names. And after that, you know, that's not, you know, the Nationals will need a closer. The Dodgers will need a closer. The Giants will need a closer. A lot of other teams will still need a closer. So there's going to be a market. And I saw that Rustin Dodd tweeted earlier that free agency is probably not going to be a very active thing for the Royals. As we've talked about, their payroll is stretched pretty much as high as they can do it. But that doesn't rule out trades, and trades could happen. And they could be the type of, you know, guys, you know, veterans for prospects, or they could be veterans for maybe younger major league caliber players, you know, kind of the kind of running in place type of things that Billy Beane has done here and there. So, you know, we'll see. The winter meetings are always interesting. There's going to be a million rumors no matter what, and most of them won't turn into anything, but it's still fun. Especially like day one is like people settle in, and day two is where it starts to kick into gear. Day three is where it's like, holy crap. And then day four, everybody kind of is done, but it should be fun.
It should be fun indeed. So with that, we'll leave you. We'll be here every week the rest of the offseason. Hopefully we'll have some more Royal stuff to talk about from some winter meetings fun. But until then, thank you so much for listening. We greatly appreciate it. We'll be here next week. Thanks for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.